This is Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. These days, it's not that unusual to have your family history torn up and rewritten when some aunt or uncle does a DNA test. Our story this hour doesn't involve a DNA test, but it does involve a historian whose research led him to crash into the lives of an African-American family in Los Angeles and then reunite them with their Mexican relatives way to the south. The whole story all centers on a former slave, a black boy born during the Civil War who rose from nothing to change his identity, run the gauntlet of racial prejudice, and become, in his prime during the early years of the 20th century, one of the wealthiest businessmen in New York City. We have with us on the line Carl Jacoby, a professor of history at Columbia University, and a man whose research reconnected a severed extended family, and for the first time told the story. Before I bring Carl into this conversation, though, I want to let you hear a little bit from Chip Williams, who's one of the California relatives of William Ellis, whose life was thrown into a little bit of confusion. Chip Williams didn't mind, though, as he told an audience at Colorado College back in 2019.
My feeling is I'm a very spiritually oriented person, and I feel like our ancestors made contact with us through Carl. And it has unfolded this whole thing for me in terms of genealogical research and getting in touch with my roots. This figure of Uncle Willie is, like, in the family, iconic, this illustrious person, and we have these anecdotes, but not the full picture. And Carl was able to weave everything that we had together into a whole. And my hope was that I hope this man and his research can find our relatives in Mexico. And he did. And we've had a wonderful reunion, and we're all friends, and we spend time together.
That was the voice of Chip Williams. So we have with us on the line Carl Jacoby, who is the author of The Strange Career of William Ellis, the former slave who became a Mexican millionaire. And Carl, why don't we start by drawing the connection between you and the Williams family? Help us understand who Chip was and what role his family in Southern California played in bringing all of this research together.
Sure. So, sort of as background, one of the real challenges about writing this book is that William Ellis is someone who was trying to hide his life story. He had been born a slave, and then he reinvents himself as a Mexican. And in the process of doing that, really tried to hide his story. So what I was trying to do as a historian was very, very challenging, which is to, you know, dig up this story that he had intentionally erased. And Chip Williams was really what part of the key of understanding this story and being able to write this book, which is to say that he is William Ellis's great-grandnephew. And by getting in contact with him and being able to confirm some of the things that I thought I was seeing in the archives and be able to get access to family documents, I was then able to understand the real story, as it were, of William Ellis's origins and reinvention.
What got you into this maze?
So this is a story of one of these very short little projects that was supposed to be a short little project, and then it turned into sort of a 10-year or so obsession, which was a testament to really how well he had hidden his story and how hard it was to unearth. It actually began all the way back in graduate school when one of my professors, knowing that I was interested in the history of the U.S.-Mexico border, told me to look at this collection of documents from the State Department about the border. And to be honest, I was looking through them. They were pretty boring at first, so like about coal exports. And I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do anything interesting about this. And then all of a sudden, I flipped the page, and there was a story from 1895 about hundreds of almost 1,000 African-American sharecroppers from Georgia and Alabama who are leaving the United States and moving to northern Mexico. And this is a huge diplomatic controversy between Mexico and the U.S. at the time. And I got very interested in who was behind this really remarkable movement. And there are these confusing clues in the documents about someone named Guillermo Eliseo or Guillermo Ellis or William Ellis. And he might be Cuban, he might be Mexican, he might be from Texas. Who was this person, and how had he come up with this really radical idea?
Did anyone know the real story here, or did you put it together really from scratch?
I mean, I would say that when I finally discovered Chip in his family, in essence, knew much of the real story. And then when I finally discovered the Mexican side of the family, they knew a little of the story. But basically, no. There's a few books. So Robin Kelly's Hammer and Hoe, which is looking at African-American labor in the South around the same time period. He has like one mention of William Ellis in this incident. So there was just very rare mentions of, but no one really knew who he was. And honestly, you're making me sort of claim a little more whatever credit than I'm often comfortable claiming. But, you know, I do feel like I was the first one to piece together this entire story.
Well, you did put yourself in a pretty remarkable, I mean, you just alluded to it yourself in passing. You said, when I discovered the Mexican side of the family, I mean, you welded a family together.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that was for me a small consolation about this is so much of the literature about the border has been about how the border has divided families, which is certainly something that we've seen and hear. In a case, this was a family that was divided by the border about a century ago, that eventually William Ellis's family moves to Mexico and they lose track with his sister's family, which Chip is descended from William Ellis's sisters. And that all gets broken up. And then about a century later, I was able to put these two halves of the family back together, both of which knew in some way that the other half existed, but had never been able to make that connection at all. And so one of the most memorable things I've done as a historian is we actually had a sort of cookout in the backyard of Chip's aunt, Fanny, in South Pasadena, which had the Mexican and the U.S. side of the family coming together for the first time in a century. And that, for me, was just a really moving and wonderful experience.
Yeah, I should think so. I you know, sometimes I hear people describe moments like that. Like they'll get up and they'll say, I am so humbled to get this award. And you know that that's just rhetoric, right? But there's something in what you're describing that seems like you would just feel like there was something so much bigger than yourself and just feel so grateful to be part of it.
Well, I mean, part of it was that the families had given me so much that I couldn't have written the book without them. And one of my more nerve-wracking experiences as a historian, actually, is when I finally tracked down Chip's family, and they all very sort of close-knit family in Southern California. And I went out to meet them, and I had shared with them all the research I'd done with William Ellis. And at this point, I'd written a short essay that kind of alluded to him a little bit. And, but I wanted to write a larger book about him, but I wanted to make sure that they were okay with it, because you never know, frankly. And I've often asked myself if some historian I didn't know showed up and was digging through my family history, would I like that or not? We like to imagine that, you know, history is unequivocally a good act and that it's, but I was revealing family secrets, as it were, and I didn't know whether they would actually be enthusiastic about it. And so for me, when I finally met them, one of the things I asked them was, you know, I really want to write this book, but I only want to do it with your approval and blessing, because I didn't want to be in a situation where I'd be struggling and fighting with the family over it. I just couldn't imagine that being happy for either of us. It would mean, on the other hand, I would have had to have thrown out several years of research and what I thought was a really great story that was just so, said so much about race and family in the U.S.-Mexico border. So I didn't want to do that, but I would have respected their wishes. And I was just so thankful that they had been gracious and said, no, we really want you to write this book that will help summarize a lot of the family history and that we can then give to subsequent generations.
Oh, my gosh. Families hire people to do things like this.
I mean, like I said, as a historian, I like to imagine what I'm doing is providing a service. But, you know, I have had colleagues who've done similar projects, and sometimes families are very invested in a particular presentation of family members. And you know, often as historians, we tend to break down, you know, myths and comfortable stories rather than reinforce them.
Maybe the notion that one of your ancestors was English aristocracy, for example.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yes, exactly.
you want to bring us to that one?
Sure. So it was very interesting. When I tracked down eventually the Mexican side of the family, in essence, that side of the family, I would have to say, was passing. So Chip's side of the family and the family in South Pasadena, they continued to identify as African-American, as everyone else in pretty much everyone else, not everyone else, but pretty much everyone else in William Ellis's family had done. And the Mexican side of the family identifies as Mexican, but they don't. They identified as mestizo, which in their mind meant at the time, it means mixed, but really in the Mexican context, mestizo usually means European and Indian. And so they did not, they know that it's their grandfather. They knew that he was not Mexican, but they had the story that they had been told by their parents, and this was quite obviously misleading them, was that he was British, and so that they were from a British family.
Wait, the story they had picked up was that William Ellis himself was from a British family?
Yeah, and also, well, I see what you're alluding to as well. Also, William Ellis marries a white woman, and who pretends to be British aristocracy, but she also was, she was actually born in Jersey City, which is very close to me here in New York. And if you know anything about Jersey City, it's kind of the gritty waterfront seaport for New York City. So she was engaged in a certain dimension of sort of class passing as well, that she was just a very working class young American, but she and William Ellis tried to persuade the world that she was actually minor British aristocracy. And somehow that tale then sort of moved out so that the people in Mexico believed that William Ellis himself was also British.
Oh, I see. So transmuted a little bit. Yeah. Well, this might be a good opportunity to actually tell the story. I think the how you put the mystery together is a lot of the fun. But let's talk about William Ellis himself, what you know about him, and if you want to just kind of like let us know how you uncover these pieces as you tell the story.
Sure. So William Ellis is born a slave in Victoria, Texas in the 1860s, so at the very twilight of slavery in Texas. And Victoria is a small town in South Texas, and it's more or less on the border, as it were, not the international border between U.S. and Mexico, but the internal border in Texas between Anglo-dominated Texas and then Tejano-dominated Texas. And Anglo-dominated Texas at this time period was, of course, dominated by slave plantations, so cotton plantations. He's born on a cotton plantation that right along the Guadalupe River. And then south of that, it's mainly Tejano cattle ranches. And so he grows up on this border, you know, between where there's a lot of Tejanos, peoples of Mexican descent, and Anglos and enslaved African Americans. And so he grows up, in essence, bilingual.
Do we know what year he was born?
It seems to be 1863, 1864. So, you know, he's very,
okay,
very
young. Okay, so he was a baby still, a toddler.
He's a baby, yeah, okay. A toddler. And then he, after emancipation, you know, he begins to work in Victoria as a translator, as it were, for a local merchant. And this merchant does a lot of business all over Texas and even into Mexico. And it's my sense that this being a translator, in essence, speaking for the businessman, as if he were the businessman, allows him in some ways to take on the persona almost of this businessman. And so in the 1880s, when he's in his mid-20s, he suddenly disappears from Victoria and he shows up in the nearest big city at the time, which is San Antonio, Texas. And he then opens his own merchant house there. But at this point, he is no longer William Ellis, the African-American. He's now Guillermo Eliseo, an ethnic Mexican.
So I would say, based on what you've said so far, that he did a kind of catch me if you can MBA.
Sort of, yeah. I think he's obviously a really bright guy and has figured out, you know, he has language skills. I think these are the things that are hard to prove because I don't have a lot of like,
right.
What I do for one of his accounting books or something.
Yeah, I remember in that presentation you gave, you put up a picture from his office on Wall Street.
Yes, so this is one of the wonderful photos. I didn't even actually have a photo of William Ellis, know exactly what he looks like, until I contacted Chip's family, and Chip's aunt Fanny has just a wonderful collection of photos which have been passed down through several generations in the family. And one of them is a picture of William Ellis's office on Wall Street, and it's really great because you see sort of two windows, and they say Mexican stocks and bonds, because he specialized in U.S. people wanted to invest in Mexico, which was quite a trend at the time. That was a specialty. And then if you look in the sort of light that's illuminating through the windows, it shows all of these stacks of ledger books and whatnot on his desk. And I have no idea what happened to all of those, but the sense for me that all those documents once existed but didn't now is the, like you said, the historian's nightmare, because you just had the sense of all the other stories and connections that I could have drawn had I had access to
them.
This was a hard book to write in the sense that often when you're writing about a figure, they have a big collection of papers and archive at the Library of Congress or whatever, and you just go there and you sort of marinate in this big, you know, their letter book and their diaries. But this wasn't the case with William Ellis. It was like a little fragment of something here, a little fragment of something there, and it's like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle with a few pieces still missing, and you just try to fit it all together as best you can so you get the overall picture.
Yeah, so he became a businessman in San Antonio, was that you said?
Yes, San Antonio.
Okay, and what have you been able to trace from there? I mean, eventually he's going to end up in Mexico and in New York. Tell me what we know about how he got to those places.
Yeah, so one reason, of course, he has to go to San Antonio is he's basically passing at this time, you know, reinventing his ethnicity. And you can't do that in your hometown, because the key issue in passing is if people know your family, they kind of locate you through your family. And if your family is known as African-American, you can't all of a sudden go run around saying, no, I'm actually not William Ellis, I'm Guillermo de Sale, I'm Mexican. No one's going to believe you. But of course, in San Antonio, they had a large ethnic Mexican population, and there's no birth certificates and there's no passports, there's very little paper documentation at the time. It's purely on your self-presentation that people tend to, quote-unquote, read your race. And so if you're able to put on a persuasive performance of your race, as William Ellis was able to do, of being Mexican, then you're believed. What Ellis does, which is really curious at this time, is as he's being this businessman in San Antonio, he still has these connections back in Victoria. And this is the sort of twilight of Reconstruction, and there's still African-American political power. And so he actually runs for office out of Victoria. I don't know how he never thought that people in San Antonio would never figure out what he was doing in Victoria. For a while, he pulls it off for a couple of years, but eventually it sort of catches up with him. And people go, oh, the William Ellis in Victoria, who's the African-American politician, is the same person as the Guillermo de Sale, supposed Mexican merchant in San Antonio. So that has basically, that scenario has been blown.
Do you have actual like paper trails for that, the blowing of his cover there?
So there are newspaper articles, and one of the things that happens is that he's with Norris Wright Cuny, who's a very important Texas political figure at the time, actually the most important probably African-American in the whole Republican Party in the whole nation at the time. And there's a piece about them going to a cantina in San Antonio right around in the 1890s, and they refuse service. And because all of a sudden they recognize that William Ellis is black.
So this shows up in a newspaper article.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is in the 1890s. This is right around the time of Plessy versus Ferguson, which is the same plot.
Yes. Yes. I mean, Plessy versus Ferguson is very interesting because, of course, and the whole issue about passing, because Plessy was we don't have any photos of Plessy, but by all known descriptions, he was so light that people didn't know his ethnic background necessarily. And so he bought the ticket with the ticket seller thinking that he was white. And then he announced on the train that he was black and wanted to be, you know, and so this was to create a challenge case that could be tried
court. So same story, same moment.
Yes, exactly. And so then William Ellis has to leave San Antonio. That's a decision point for him. I can stay in San Antonio, but be African-American in Texas at this particular, you know, very difficult time to be African-American in Texas, although, of course, his family members are all around there as well, are doing it. or I can leave and try to continue my reinvention, but it will have to be elsewhere. And then he eventually reappears in New York City. And then, as you were saying, he basically sort of has his bi-national existence, as it were, where he has an office on Wall Street in New York City, right around the corner from J.P. Morgan, which is a preeminent Wall Street investment bank of the time period. And then he has an office very close to the Zocalo and the sort of heart of Mexico City as well. And he really divides his time. Locations, and eventually he's living on the Upper West Side, sort of right on Central Park West, actually, if you know anything about New York, is one of the preeminent addresses in New York. And then he moves out to Mount Vernon, which is one of the very early sort of suburbs, fancy suburbs of New York.
You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. We're speaking this hour with Carl Jacoby, a professor of history at Columbia University and the author of The Strange Career of William Ellis, the Texas Slave Who Became a Mexican Millionaire. We're going to take a really short break, and when we get back, we're going to talk about the effect that these revelations had on the Mexican relatives of William Ellis. They had no idea that their roots ran over to America and included former slaves. How did this affect how they saw themselves? We'll find out. Constant Wonder, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. We're speaking this hour with Carl Jacoby, a professor of history at Columbia University and the author of The Strange Career of William Ellis, the Texas Slave Who Became a Mexican Millionaire. Carl, when you brought the Mexican family together with the American branch of the family, one of the questions you asked was how they felt about this discovery that, you know, that they were African-American in their roots. I noted a very interesting response from one of the, like, who seemed to be the spokesman for the Mexican branch.
Yes, this was Peter Ellis, who would be William Ellis's grandson. And I asked him this because, as we were discussing earlier, you know, they had imagined that their family was, you know, very Tony British aristocracy and not African-American. And I was curious because, of course, in the American racial imagination, we, in essence, still have the one-drop law, which is to say that if you have any African-American ancestry, you're usually imagined to be African-American. And so for a white American, if you found out that one of your ancestors was African-American, someone who thought of themselves as white as being descended from a British family, if you found out that one of your ancestors was, in fact, African-American, that might really catalyze a really radical sense of transformation of your identity. And he said, well, it doesn't really change my identity that much, which is to say that we'd always thought of our family as mestizo, as mixed, indigenous and European. But mestizo just means mixed. And so now I realize that we're much more mestizo than I had realized before, that we're also of African descent as well. But it doesn't really change our sense of identity. And I thought that reinforced one of the points I was trying to get at in the book, which is just trying to, again, restate this idea about how race is a social and cultural construct. And so peoples look, actually, if you can see some of the pictures, we've taken pictures together, look fairly similar, the two sides of the family on both sides of the border. But one side thinks about themselves as Mexican, one side thinks about themselves as African-American. It's not that one side is right and one side is wrong. They're both right. It's that it only makes sense within sort of their own particular national context. And so that the border between U.S. and Mexico also traces a sort of a cultural border about how race is understood.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine a more elegant illustration of that point.
One of the things that William Ellis is playing with is so much is the issue of do people really want to pigeonhole, Americans really want to pigeonhole people about race. He learns very easily that that can actually be an advantage for him, that he can actually let people make strategic mistakes and sort of not correct them. I'm guessing though, when he first sort of played with this is he spoke Spanish a lot. He was probably speaking Spanish with some of his Mexican friends.
He was in that border area, you said, yeah. where it basically tipped, and he came yeah. out probably speaking quite fluently, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. And so some Anglo probably thought he was Mexican and started talking to him and treating him in that way. And William Ellis didn't feel like, I need to go out of my way to explain to you, I'm not Mexican, I'm actually, you know, African-American, blah, blah, blah. And so he just kind of took it and ran with it. And it's kind of like taking the stereotypes that Anglo-Americans have and, you know, playing with them and so actually finding, you know, there's a little bit of power in these stereotypes if you know how to manipulate them in the way that William Ellis did, so that you send some signals and they can be misinterpreted and people can imagine that you can't be African-American. So I think one of the photos I sent you, and it's on the cover of the book like this as well, William Ellis would dress exquisitely. He'd have a top hat and lots of jewels.
Oh, very impressive photos, yeah. Yeah.
And just part of the reason people never thought he was African-American is, you know, the idea of African-Americans are supposed to be, you know, poor and whatnot. And he just doesn't send any of that. And so that was one way of sort of just manifesting yourself as not African-American and making this sort of facade or charade of being Mexican much more believable. And one of the other things that he discovered, the other weaknesses in racial thinking or in white stereotypes is that, you know, whites thought that they could tell clearly who's black and who's not. And if they have started to treat you as not being black, as a Mexican or whatever, and accept you in that way, they're actually very deeply invested in not having the truth come out. And so in an odd way, some of the people that William Ellis has tricked, these very prominent whites, become his biggest defenders. I spent all this time with him one-on-one. There's no way he could be African-American because how could I do that with an African-American? You know, how could I have been on such close contact with an African-American? All these things that would have been unthinkable with an African-American.
Right.
But New York City in the Gilded Age, when William Ellis was here, even a little bit today, it's constantly people reinventing themselves. So William Ellis
sure.
is tripping over these people who, you know, Wall Street is, what has that not been people coming and pretending to put on this facade of whatever? And William Ellis, you know, as he's trying to pull his various tricks, there's other people who are trying to trick him, who are convincing him that they're, I think one of them is trying to say that they're a Hungarian, some sort of Eastern European count. And there's all these other people who are involved in all these other forms of self-presentation.
And
then he married one of them, right? he married his wife is one of these people as well. And so, although I think they colluded in that, people have asked
yeah.
me whether she
yeah.
tricked him, but I think they were kind of both realized that the kind of wife that he was supposed to marry could not be a poor girl from the, you know, the,
right.
the slums of Jersey City. She had to be minor nobility. And again, it was, if you could pull the charade off, people would believe you. And
right.
they did.
And I saw pictures of his family with the two little boys, and they looked like Prince William and Prince Harry.
Yeah, no, they're dressed, you know, exquisitely in these like Little Lord Fauntleroy outfits.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're living in Mount Vernon at the time, which is a all-white suburb. You know, again, this is one of those that he can only get in there because of the covenants and everything else. If you're presenting as a pure white family.
Oh, yeah. So this is in like first decade of the 20th century. When is this?
Yeah. Very early 20th century, right when the train goes in. And so if you look at the census data for Mount Vernon,
he's white.
He's white. And the only people who are, mm-hmm. let's see, for colored usually are servants. You could have a live-in servant who would.
So he clearly was mestizo if he was Mexican. And yet that didn't seem to throw people off up there.
Part of it is at this time, I find this funny because now actually Mexicans are one of the fastest growing ethnic groups in New
right.
York City, which hadn't been the case. I lived here back in the 80s and there was a very small Mexican population that's just grown a lot. But, you know, in the Gilded Age, it was very, very small number of Mexicans and more Cubans. But in an odd way, they were always seen as in this sort of interstitial category of being Latino, which is, like white. And so as long as you could sort of climb in that somewhat vague category, then you were often accepted as white. It was really not being African-American that was the sort of really bright wine.
We're speaking with Carl Jacoby, a professor of history at Columbia University and the author of The Strange Career of William Ellis, the Texas Slave Who Became a Mexican Millionaire. We're going to go to a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a trip to Ethiopia, where he's going to do a star turn as a diplomat and meet the king of Ethiopia. Constant Wonder will be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. We're speaking this hour with Carl Jacoby, the author of The Strange Career of William Ellis, the Texas Slave Who Became a Mexican Millionaire. Carl Jacoby, I want to go to what became of his fortune under the Mexican Revolution, which is kind of a sad story. But before we go there, we have to go to Ethiopia.
Okay, so this is the one story that fits only loosely a little bit with the sort of larger story of the U.S.-Mexico border that I was trying to tell with William Ellis. But I think they're connected in the sense that one of the things for William Ellis, I think at some point he realized he, although he was well connected with Porfirio in Mexico, he was never going to be quite the major player that he wanted to be because there were other people who'd gotten there before him and had better connections with Porfirio Diaz. But in the turn of the last century, Ethiopia enjoys tremendous prestige in the African-American community as the one place in Africa that has not been colonized by European powers and, in fact, quite decisively defeats Italian colonial invading force in the 1890s.
And then so, very nearly beats them again in the 30s.
Yeah. And so William Ellis, he takes, I think, and this is where I think also why maybe the metaphor of passing is imperfect, the description of passing, because I think it's suggestive that how William Ellis, even as he's presenting as a Mexican, throughout his life, he's always very interested in African-American politics and African-American causes. And that's always a kind of risky thing to do because you look too interested in that and people are going to start to wonder, why is this Mexican?
Well, that was your entry point.
Yeah. Why is this Mexican, you know, interested in this? And so he, William Ellis goes very early and makes connections with some of the people in the royal court. And then he goes to Ethiopia early on and meets King Menelik, who's the king who had led the army that had defeated the Italian invaders, and makes his close connections with him. And it's right around the time when the U.S. Under Teddy Roosevelt is engaging with its first diplomatic negotiations. And so he really gets in, he meshes himself in, he kind of worms his way in to the diplomatic negotiations there. He initially volunteers with Roosevelt that he'll take the treaty back to King Menelik himself. But they're like, you know, this guy, we don't know who he is, or he's not a diplomat. We're not going to have that.
That is really funny. It's kind of like that Zelig catch me if you can thing going on again.
Yeah, and so they're like, well, we can't have this non-diplomat do this. They choose this sort of random guy named Kent Loomis, who is the younger brother of, I think, the Secretary of State. And they say he'll take it over. But Ellis, again, sort of displaying his tremendous, I think, charisma and everything else, quickly becomes Kent Loomis's best friend. And again, as I was saying, they're staying together, which, you know, again, if this was an African-American person, you wouldn't stay in a hotel room with him. They share a stateroom on a fancy first-class steamer going across the Atlantic. Again, something you would have not done with an African-American. Kent Loomis, of course, is white, white American. And then the big mystery here is that a few days before they're supposed to land in England, which is the first leg of the trip that would eventually bring them to Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, Kent Loomis vanishes and seems to fall overboard, or there's a few people who think that Kent Loomis was pushed overboard by William Ellis.
Whoa.
And so I... You know, my own reading is, I'm, of course, it's unknowable, although I think that I don't, what happens as a result of this is that William Ellis does end up taking the treaty to Addis Ababa and to King Menelik himself, because Kent Lewis has disappeared during the journey. And so those who think that William Ellis would have done this, would have pushed him overboard, the argument might be that either Kent Lewis figured out who he was, or that William Ellis was so anxious to be the one to deliver the treaty that he got rid of Kent Lewis. The counterargument would be that, you know, this kind of brazen murder of a diplomat is the kind of thing that attracts a lot of attention, as it did.
That's a pretty strong counterargument.
Yeah, and, you know, all the accounts I have is that, you know, Ellis gets interviewed at great length by the State Department and even Teddy Roosevelt when he comes back, and he was supposedly very nervous, and I would think that, you know, this is a thing that would potentially really betray your secret, and I can't conclusively say one way or another in the book. I tend to be a little suspicious that he would do it. On the other hand, one book reading I did in San Antonio, the San Antonio Book Fair, I was going in early to the room, and this woman came out to meet me, and she said, "Would you sign a copy of the book for me?" The book on William Ellis, The Strange Career of William Ellis. And I said, "Sure." And I said, "Who should I make it out to?" And she said something like, "Susan Loomis." And I looked at her and I said,
"Oh my gosh."
And I said, "Loomis, I said, are you related to Kent Loomis?" She was looking at me like trying to see if I would pick up.
Oh, sure. I can picture that. You can picture the saying it and looking you straight in the eye.
Yeah. And I said, "Oh," and she said, yes, I'm whatever, directly related to Kent Loomis.
By the way, New York moment behind us here.
Yes.
This is Columbia University. Let's see. That sounds like an ambulance.
I think it's an ambulance. I'm pretty close to a hospital. It's not so bad now, but
okay.
During the COVID, the COVID epidemic, I used to teach from this office, and it was really, really noisy.
All right, so this Loomis person has this funny exchange. Finish that thought with us.
So I asked her. I said, "Well, what does the family say about what William Ellis did to Kent Loomis? What do they think that?" And she's like, "Oh, he definitely pushed him overboard. He definitely killed Kent Loomis." So their family folklore is that Ellis did it.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Yeah. You got to tell me, there's a really crazy story you tell about how one of your colleagues in your profession turned out to be a descendant of the family that had enslaved the Ellis family.
Yeah, there's a lot of really weird connections in this project that makes me, I'm not a big believer in kismet or fate or whatever, but makes me feel that there was... I like to think that it shows history binds us in all these ways that we only don't always know. And actually the study of history can help us to understand better the connections that we have between human beings. One of the first questions I asked the family, because you can't find this in census data, the family that had enslaved your family in Victoria, Texas, what was their name? So I can start to research that family and figure out what's going on. And they said it was the Weisiger family, which turns out to be how the other people pronounce Weisiger. And I have a friend who's a historian, very distinguished historian at the University of Oregon, named Marcia Weisiger. And I wrote her an email, which I guess was probably a somewhat indiscreet email or a little not the most tactful email of my part. Was, "Would you have any connection to this Weisiger family in Victoria?" And it turns out that actually, yeah, that the Joseph Weisiger, who her family is originally from Kentucky, her branch of the family, Joseph Weisiger, who moved with his third wife down to Victoria, he left behind some of his kids and his grandkids in Kentucky. And that's from whom Marsh is descended. But Joseph Weisiger is a lineal descendant of hers.
Your ancestor, well, lineal ancestor,
lineal ancestor.
We knew what you meant.
Of hers, yes. So they're directly connected to that family. And it was great because when I wanted to get into Victoria and actually see the property and meet the Weisiger family, then to be able to have Marcia Weisiger there and help facilitate those introductions, which she really generously did.
Yeah.
That was really helpful, other than being, "Hi, I'm this person, and you want to talk about slave owning in your family."
Right.
A difficult conversation for a lot of people to have. Yeah. I've been after Marcia to write a book about this because, you know, I'm not really that interested or for the purpose of the book, William Ellis is the heart of the book.
It's peripheral,
There's another story to be told about these two families, the enslaved family of the Ellises and the Weisiger family, I'm convinced to have had multiple generations going all the way back. But, you know, Marcia being a historian and then really already having these, you know, I already found the connections to the Ellis family for her. I think she could write a really great book that would take up a lot of these issues. Because I do think there's also been this sort of reflexive effort to say, either it was a long time ago, or I don't know. I think it's a very complicated, great as like the most awesome and, you know, weighty, one of the most weighty subjects in American history. And we really need a thoughtful book.
Yeah. Why don't you conclude by telling us he did not die wealthy and that had a lot to do with Mexican politics. Could you just wrap that up for us?
Yes. Well, so of course, the problem of aligning your star so closely with Porfirio Diaz is that once the Mexican Revolution comes around, which is basically this massive uprising, which is against Porfirio Diaz and his economic order, then all of a sudden, William Ellis, all these connections that he spent, you know, decades cultivating, all go out the window, and they become liabilities, basically. And so William Ellis, he's able to navigate surprisingly well. The Mexican Revolution is full of different factions that compete with one another, and he's able to surprisingly move between competing factions in a way that only someone like he could do. But even so, American investment, you know, in Mexico collapses. That was his great vehicle for generating wealth. And so he dies in the 1920s, fairly young. He's about 59, 60 when he dies. And I have to believe the stress of both his double life and then all of the economic setbacks that he had probably contributed to his early death. And then one of the scandals that emerges is he leaves this just tiny estate to his widow, a couple thousand dollars. And even that may be exaggerating because I have letters that his widow wrote to William Ellis's sisters, who were these letters that went down to Chip's family, and they're complaining, well, actually, he took out a secret second mortgage on the house, which we have to pay off, and all these other things. And so he basically dies penniless.
Did you mention yet that one of the black newspapers in New York outed him in terms of his race as well?
No. So, I mean, that's one of the other fascinating parts about it. And so the first newspapers to cover William Ellis's death are the white newspapers. It's the very first obituary is in the Mount Vernon newspaper, the Argus, and they basically recapitulate the sort of the story, as it were, that Ellis had been telling about his life with this Mexican businessman, who'd been a cowboy, who'd grown up along the frontier, blah, blah, blah. The New York Times does a longer one, but, you know, given the idea that it's our newspaper of record, it's pretty much equally mistaken, as it basically, again, recapitulates the story of his life that William Ellis had helped to share with the world. But the really interesting obituaries are in the African-American newspapers, like the Amsterdam News after he passes. And it's at this moment, periodically the Amsterdam News has had articles while Ellis was alive that mentioned Ellis. And I think that if a smart reader would know, why are they talking about Ellis? Because I think that the African-American community knew, but they were keeping his secret. But once he passes away, I think they felt they didn't need to do that anymore. And they also, there was a bit of pride. You know, you guys keep saying like African Americans just can't make it, but look, this person was tremendously successful. And, you know, he did actually circulate with King Menelik, with Theodore Roosevelt, with Porfirio Diaz. You know, it was, you know, close accounts with all of those people, and, you know, was on Wall Street. And so, incidentally, there's some debate about this, but I like to say William Ellis was the first African-American on Wall Street. So they like to claim him and say, like, it's not, you know, African-American shortcomings that are allowing, not preventing them from flourishing. It's basically white prejudice, and someone who was able to fool all of you and get around that white prejudice was able to succeed quite extraordinarily.
Sure. Yeah. So last thing then. I know when you mentioned earlier that you, like, are not a big believer in fate, but Chip Williams is. He said that he thinks that his ancestors put you onto this.
Could be. I mean, yeah, so he's a much more spiritual person than me. I think, I don't know. I would say that this project, I've liked all my projects in interesting ways about being a historian is a very odd process because on one level, it's very isolating. You have to spend a lot of time in archives and then in your office writing this stuff up by yourself. But it's also allowed me to form these really wonderful connections. And so Chip is now, I would say, one of my closest friends. Like, we're just very, very close.
It comes through in the film, yeah.
We're just tremendously fond of each other. And when Chip refers to me sometimes as a member of the family, and I just can't, I'm just really choked up whenever he says that, because it just is such a wonderful feeling, more than I ever hoped for as a historian. And so in an odd way, if there's a spiritual side to this, it's like making these really intimate connections with new people. One of the best other experiences I've had as a historian is right after the book came out in 2017, Peter Ellis, the grandson of William Ellis in Mexico, his daughter got married, Paulina, and we were invited, all of us, to the wedding. So my wife flew down, I flew down, Chip and his Aunt Fanny, and we all participated in this wedding in Mexico, the only non-Mexicans there. But but in particular, I was the only non-family member there in the sense that, Chip was there as representing the U.S. side of the family and his aunt. And just to be in that event and feel that sort of knitting together a family was a really wonderful experience.
Wow. I wasn't going to bring this up, but it's probably not lost on you that we out here in Utah and at BYU have a particular interest in the story you just told.
You do?
Well, I mean...
Just because of genealogy?
Genealogy? I mean, what you just said about the knitting together of families, I mean, we do genealogy just for sport?
No. So, I mean, I actually did a little research for this at the main... library there in Salt Lake City of the Mormon Church, because obviously they're the best records belong there.
That's what we do.
Yeah.
Well, this is a tremendous story. I mean, I just got chills. There were several times in your conversation, in your story, where I kind of got chills, and it makes you feel, in the ways that you described at the outset of kind of the inherent connectedness that we all have that's far richer than we usually know.
Yeah, it's made me realize, I think there is all of that, and that we go through the life normally with a very thin understanding of that.
Yeah.
And ideally, history gives us these moments when we can actually begin to see it in a thicker way and really see the depth of the connections.
Absolutely. Carl Jacoby is a professor of history at Columbia University and the author of The Strange Career of William Ellis, the Texas Slave Who Became a Mexican Millionaire. Carl, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Eric Schultzke there, and I'm Marcus Smith. If you have ever suspected that your subconscious might be speaking to you through your dreams, you just very well may be right. Tomorrow, here on Constant Wonder, we explore the science of dreams. We'll be speaking to a leading researcher on dream science, which has made enormous leaps in just the past 2 decades. That's tomorrow on Constant Wonder.